This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Jamie Percival. How are you, Jamie?
Yeah, feeling good today. Glad to be back. Thank you.
Excellent, excellent. Last week we had you on the show and we were talking about the WCT Level 1 and 2 course in beer. This week we're going to touch a little bit on that, but I really wanted to just tease out a little bit about the world of beer, because the world of beer, I think, is probably different to the world of wine in terms of both the people who inhabit it sometimes and also the structure of the business. And there's one thing that I find really similar to wine, and that's hops. Hops and beer seems to have a very strong analogy to wine. You know, we're called 30-50, but if we're in the beer world, we'll probably be called 35-55.
Yeah, well, you're referencing there where hops are grown, aren't you? Yeah. 35 to 55 degrees of latitude.
Just to recap yourself, you've been in the trade for 21 years.
I have.
Started out as enthusiasts, worked in pubs, worked for breweries. Now you run your own, but what's your business? We didn't give it a plug last week. It was
So my business is called the Craft Beer Club. It's an online subscription club that's set up to basically build boxes, compile boxes for you on a monthly basis based off your taste preference, actually. And a good example there is, like, if you love pale and hoppy beers, we create that box. If you love dark beers only, we do that box. I just think the craft beer and indie world and the consumers actually wanted something that was a little bit more personable or tailored to their taste, such as that.
I thought one of the products you mentioned, because when we were doing the course, we talked about gluten-free beers. Mm-hmm. And you do a gluten-free box as well, which,
yeah.
If you're I've got a mate who's gluten intolerant, and he was visiting us, and we went off and down to where we get some beers from, and he was just amazed at the amount of gluten-free beer. And he's back in New Zealand, where he's from, you know, there's 4 or 5 beers, and there's not a lot of choice, but over here, he was well blown away. And you do a whole box of gluten-free beers for people, and it changes as well.
Every month. And the story there is very similar to you, actually. So I have a very close friend called Tom, and he basically was enjoying the subscription. I've been drinking beer with him for years. He got some tests done and found out that he was gluten intolerant. And that was a little bit of a shock to him, and he suddenly started drinking cider instead. I said to him, look, let me assess the market.
You could always choose wine. Wine's gluten-free.
I think he does like wine a lot, to be honest with you. He used to be involved in a very good wine bar down by the Strand. But in terms of the gluten-free beers, I thought, well, I haven't really looked at this market closely enough, because I never really had to. I don't have a gluten intolerance, but I looked on his behalf. Is there enough out there coming from the small indie brewers in a range of styles that we can create a mixed box on a monthly basis? And there was. And the box that I showed up in the course, and I'll probably change it from course to course if more interesting boxes come up, but it had a New England Pale Ale, which is a hazy pale ale. It had a Mango Berliner Weiss, which is a sour beer that's also had mango puree added during the maturation stage. It had a Munich Helles, which is a lager style. It had a Czech Pilsner, which is another lager style, but has a little bit more bitterness to it. The list goes on. The gluten-free world is definitely expanded into quite an array of beer styles, and we thought we'd create a box that we could compile on a monthly basis that was not only very flexible in terms of the styles that we put in, but a good range for people to really enjoy. And even for those that are just looking for a good mixed box, to be honest with you, it has that versatility with it.
Okay. Let's talk a bit about the beer world and the way it's structured. Let me explain how the wine world's structured. And you can give me an analogy or say, no, the beer is completely different. So in the wine world, we look at producers into 3 categories as a general rule of thumb. You've got estates or chateaus or domains, whatever you want to call it. They're small producers, small to medium-sized producers. They tend to grow the grapes. They've got good quality control, not a problem. You've got co-ops who the owners supply grapes, then they make wine and they market them. And then you've got really what in WST speak negotiants, but really it's anybody who buys in a lot of their grapes and turns that into wine.
Are there a lot of laws involved in this by chance?
No, rules and regulations.
About how you set up and...
No rules like that. But
okay.
But there's labeling conventions.
Okay.
Like if you can't, in France, for example, you can't put the word domain on your bottle unless you own the land that the grapes were grown on.
Oh, I love that. Okay.
So there's things like that. But in terms of the wine world, you can make money in any of those things. You know, you can be a really large negotiant, and Jacobs Creek, Hardy's, Accolade's a big one, but you won't have heard of them. But those sort of things, they can be very, very big. And then you can have very, very small. You know, you've got that whole range. In beer, I think of it as being huge international brewers like Carlsberg, Keren, BrewDog. Those sort of, I always like to, because they are big international brewer. I know they like to, I like to just lump them in because they are an international brewer and they are big. So they won't appreciate that.
Perhaps not. Gone are the days when they used to turn up outside beer festivals in tanks. But yeah, they're definitely.
And then you've got small craft brewers, even micro breweries. You know, we've got one, two doors down from us. Or three doors down from us, and they're pretty small as well, one-man bands. And then you've got things in the middle, like maybe Saracen. Is it Saracen?
Siren Craft Brew.
Siren Craft Brews, who aren't tiny, but they're not huge either. So that's the way I think about it. But the wine world's got its particular structures. But how is have I got that structure right for beer, or is it different, or what's going on?
So I think there's some similarities, but also differences. And I hope that one of the differences I'm going to say is there are quite an array of opinions on this topic. So I'm going to say mine, according to what I think is just the easiest way to explain it. You've got macro and you've got micro, large and then small. That's based on the volume of hectolitres you produce per year. So, for example, over in America, you cannot be a micro craft brewery unless you're producing below a certain amount of hectolitres per year.
Is that legislative or...?
That's according to the Craft Brewing Organization,
okay,
but so I don't think it's legislative, no.
No.
But that's a very, very good example where macro producers, for example, Diageo, who produce Guinness, Carlsberg, obviously with their lager, Asahi, producing Asahi and Peroni, etc., etc. They are macro producers. They're very, very big, and they have a global touch, or a global reach, you should say, when it comes to where they're sending their beers to, or distributing their beers. Micro producers... This is where you could be, and I quite literally mean this, any Tom, Dick and Harry could be a microproducer. And this is where craft beer came in about 30, 35 years ago, off the back of enthusiastic homebrewers setting up their own routes to market and wanting to eventually create a brewery in their own hometown in America or in the UK particularly, and start selling beer to just their local area. And that has gone from, in 2003, we had about 600 microbreweries in the UK. There's now nearly 3,000. So the growth has been astonishing. I mean, I remember in London in 2008. In 2008, there were three breweries in London. There's now 158, I think it is. So the growth has just completely changed. And it's like what you said. You've got the small brewery around the corner. Then you've got a slightly bigger brewery like Siren Craft Brew. And then you might have Molson Coors producing Coors Light, which is like the next level up. How does everyone talk about themselves? And how do we...
Yeah, how would you put, say, someone like Fuller's in there?
Well, Fuller's is owned by Asahi now, so they're macro. So,
yeah, macro.
They traditionally would have been a microbrewery.
Yeah, yeah, because they're a London-based...
London-based, relatively small brewery, very large pub estate, of course. And I think that a lot of the breweries that have actually succeeded over the years do have pub estates that go with them. But not only is it a good, consistent way place to sell your product, but it's also a very good sort of... but very good way of actually getting money from the industry that you're selling into, shall we say.
You don't see wineries only more than maybe a tasting room, and they might have a restaurant, but that's about it. But in the brewing world, it's very common to own the outlet. And I think one of the reasons for that is twofold. First of all, beer needs to be stored cold and transportation, and it's got a short shelf life. Wine, a year isn't that bad for wine, where beer... That's probably the end of most beers. So
this is one thing we talk about in the course, isn't it? I mean, if those don't know, you have to keep beer fresh and cold. We have to keep it cold to keep it fresh. And the key point here is that unfortunately beer can stale quite quickly. It's best drunk within the first 3 to 6 months of its life.
Yeah.
What happens when it starts to stale? Well, particularly with hops, the aroma can fade, as can the bitterness. Worst case scenario, you unfortunately get those staling aromas of wet cardboard, wet paper. I'm not going to ask your listeners to go and smell some wet cardboard, but you can imagine it. It's not particularly nice.
It smells like. It's the same thing. But if you think about it, that drives the industry into certain ways. Because
it does,
short shelf life and the cool chain required, domestic and local sales are by far much more profitable than international sales. So a brewery in England, it's a lot harder for them to ship to the US or the US to ship to England for a micro brewer than it is for wine industry. Wine industry, stick it on a boat, and if it takes 3 months to get there, that's not really a big problem. But for beer, that's a serious issue.
There is a little bit of ignorance is bliss going on here as well, Chris, I'm afraid. So there is, for instance, charters for distribution across the UK to advise people that all beer should be chilled down to a certain temperature when it's been sat in a depot and when it's being transported. How many of the transport depots ignore that advice? Over 90%, which effectively means a lot of the beer that you get delivered, whether it be in a can or in a bottle, or especially in a cask or a keg being delivered to pubs, they've not been chilled on the way to the pub, unfortunately. It relies on the chilling that's happening in the pub cellars to get that beer back down to a relatively good temperature to keep it cool and to keep it for as fresh for as long as possible. Why do they ignore it? A lot of the products that are pasteurized, for example, don't need to be kept as cold as others. And they don't believe that it has as much an adverse effect on the product, because that exposure to heat for 5 days shouldn't affect it as much as people think it should. Newsflash here, people, it does, I'm afraid. That exposure to heat can really dramatically change that beer, and that's something that we should improve. And this is where the micro producers are a lot better. They really, really care about that cold chain for every single can, cask, bottle, or keg that gets sent out. They want it to be sold as fresh as possible, and they want it to be distributed as cold as possible, so that every person that samples their beer gets the best product possible.
I imagine a lot of the big breweries have a similar, at least on paper, ethos. But when you are exporting and doing volumes like that, it's harder. But some of the big breweries brew locally, like BrewDog brews in Brisbane, they brew in America, they brew in the UK, so that they can meet the demand and brew it locally. Whereas in the wine industry, for example, we don't make Chablis in America, and we don't make Chablis in Australia either. Well, the Australians used to call it Chablis.
This is actually one of the things that you mentioned earlier that I was going to touch on. It's the fact that you can brew anywhere with any ingredient you like. You don't have to rely on being in a certain region to be able to make a certain beer.
In the past, you had to.
In the past, there was a point when you had to, but we can package oxygen seal package hops across from New Zealand all the way over to the UK, and you can brew with them. Mm. And there are experimental hops being sent here all the time by some very, very good hop farm retailers and hop farm growers. And the experimentation within that world has evolved so, so much. The same goes with malt. So, for example, in England, we grow Maris Otter. Maris Otter is a sought-after malt type from brewers all around the world. So particularly the Americans love buying our Maris Otter malt. So they take ingredients from us, we take ingredients from them, and you brew wherever your equipment is set up. That could be in your kitchen in your house, or it could be in a commercial plant brewery pushing out upwards of 20,000 hectolitres of beer to the southeast region of the UK, for example. But that ability to start up and create wherever you like is what I think has drawn a lot of people to becoming brewers.
But also it means that big multinationals, that's how they get around this difficulty in shipping, is Guinness is produced in Ireland, but it's also produced
in
other places as well. And that means that they don't have to ship the big beer. I'm just talking about the structure. I'm trying to just tease out the structural differences. And a lot of them are based around the difference in beer, really, isn't it? In terms of both the cool chain and the shippability and the fact that it's repeatable. You can ship ingredients, make the beer, and then it's there. You know, the main ingredient is water. So, you know, it's easier to ship ingredients really and brew locally if you want to save your carbon footprint.
No, of course. And one of the things that's changed about brewing in the last couple of decades as well is that you can now make your own water. What do I mean by that?
I know. You drink some Foster's and then about 8 hours later...
Oh, that's a bad, bad joke, but I love it all the same. Love it all the same. Yes, I mean, one of the things we touched on, of course, is the fact that if you want a beer that's going to amplify the hop bitterness, what type of mineral ions would we like in that beer, please?
Hop bitterness, you want sulfur.
Sulfates. So we want sulfates. And a really good example of that is that any brewer in the whole world now, with a little bit of technology, a little bit of aid of technology, they can make sure that their water has the addition of mineral iron sulfates so that it amplifies the hop bitterness. Now, that's something that we used to just call Burtonization. And effectively that meant that it was taken after the water that is naturally available in Burton-on-Trent in the UK. But little details like that mean that brewers can create particular beer styles, especially hop beers that need hop bitterness more to be more pronounced, anywhere in the world. And I just love that about beer, because it means that you effectively can do any beer style, which there are hundreds, in any region all across the world. You just need somebody that's willing to drink it. And I have to say, here's one for you. The Duchesse de Bourgogne, the Flanders Red, has that lovely acetic vinegar characteristic. Was that a beer that you ever imagined before trying it?
No. That was one of the beers I had on New Year's Eve that really went down like a lip balloon. Okay. One of the other characteristics, just comparing wine to beer.
Please.
Is hops.
Yes.
And hops I found to be amazingly similar to grape growing.
Many similarities, yeah.
You've got a product that grows 35 to 55 degrees Celsius as opposed to 30 to 50 for wine, which means that a lot of the wine-producing regions are hop-producing regions, or potentially could be hop-producing regions as well, which is interesting. And then you've got the different genetics. You've got German hops versus British hops versus, or I don't know if they're genetically wildly different, like different species, but they definitely have a difference to them. For example, we talked about, you know, German hops having a particular profile, American hops having a very different.
So the word is terroir in the wine world, right?
Yeah. Well, not in my podcast, but yeah, a lot of people use that.
Love it. So hops copies or is very similar to wine in exactly the way that you would expect to talk about grapes. You've got to look at the soil structure that's been used, where the hops are being grown in terms of on the slope, the amount of rainfall, the amount of sunlight it's exposed to, the temperature and the location in the world in terms of latitude. All those factors come in when you're deciding what type of hops you're growing and what the characteristics are you're going to get from those hops. And this is what you're actually looking to get. So hops produce alpha acids and they produce essential oils. And those alpha acids are what helps us to create bitterness. And those essential oils are what give us aroma in beer. And hops are the main flavoring that we actually have in all beers around the world. They are probably the sort of celebrity of the beer world, if you will, in terms of ingredients. Most people know about them or have heard of them. What do they do? How are they grown? How are they created? And this is where, let's say, they're similar to grapes, but come and find out more, because there's a lot of detail about hops and how they've been grown and how they've been used. Very simple example, a nice little story here. Hops were first used as an antibacterial because they have a wonderful preserving quality. So when we were trying to ship beer across to troops in India, we needed to try and ship beer that would actually last a couple of months on these ships. And the first couple of trips did not work very well. The beer went horribly sour and stale and was undrinkable. So
the troops will still drink it.
I'm sure they would. I'm sure they would have drunk absolutely anything at that point just to get something down them that had some level of alcohol in it. So what they did was they came up with the solution. We need two things that are able to preserve the beer longer: higher strength and hops. So they started adding hops into these beers. And they transported for about 3 months. And the finished beer arrived in India, incredibly bitter, with an ABV probably upwards of 15%, and that was dispensed out to the officers, and then a diluted version was given down to the troops. And that beer style is called IPA.
Indian Pale Ale.
India Pale Ale, yeah. So there's a sort of like a Chinese whisper around the industry. A lot of people call it Indian Pale Ale. It's India, named after the country because of this particular story of the traveling on the trip. But yeah, hops at first were used for antibacterial properties. They later became a very, very special ingredient that were used for flavoring.
I suppose that's because the British hops, they're not as intense or pronounced as the Americans, so they're more subtle. So early on, it was all about the bitterness, I suppose, and the antibacterial.
Well, yeah, hops would have been grown more around hedgerows and trees. They wouldn't have necessarily been grown to the same extent from an agricultural point of view as they are now. Now we have full dedicated farms to growing hops in all the different regions of the world that they are very, very native. For example, Britain, of course. And good examples of British hops that we discussed, like East Kent Goldings, Fuggles.
I love the name Fuggles.
I love the name Fuggles as well. And then also Challenger and Target, for example. All these hops are grown here in the UK, but the one thing that you should point out about the UK is our climate. It's not got the same heat level or temperature or humidity that you would get, for example, in the West Coast of America, where those hops produce much more intense citrus, tropical fruit and stone fruit aromas, and also some pine and resin. British hops are a lot more delicate, more subtle, earthy, floral, herbal. You might get more of a rose, geranium and black tea characteristic than you would get, for example, a grapefruit. Mm. And that's the type of hops that we were using to ship into, put into the beer that was being shipped to India.
Let's just touch back onto the WCT course, because I do want to remind people that we run this course. Well, Jamie will be running this course going forward, and we're going to be running them regularly. The main objective is to run them on either a weekend and a Monday or a Tuesday. I think at the moment we've got everything scheduled for Tuesdays and Saturdays or Sundays. Then we've got dates coming up, but the nice thing about this is, like all our courses, we're doing them live streamed, which means you can do them anywhere in the UK. You could potentially do the level one almost anywhere in the world, but I would say Europe, and you just need to source some beers yourself, which aren't ridiculously expensive, I must admit, for the beer course. So if anybody was considering doing it, I think anybody in the Europe it would be suitable for, because you can do the exam online as well. You just need a little bit of help sourcing some beers, but we'd probably be able to help you with that. So we've just started running the courses now. We've gone through our first cycle of them. They went exceedingly well. Very good. Thank you very much, Jamie, for your presentations and running it. But it was a very, very, very good course. And I think just talking about the similarities between wine and beer, there are big differences. But if you have a wine knowledge, you can learn these differences, and then a lot of stuff falls out naturally. And that's what I like about learning, is when you can take something you know, apply it to a different framework, and then all of a sudden a lot of things that you don't seem to make sense all of a sudden come out, and they make sense to you. And that's what I quite like about it. But also the course is suitable particularly for the trade as well. That's why we're doing some courses on Tuesdays and sometimes Mondays, depending on the dates.
So, I mean, yeah, the flexibility with doing courses with the trade as well, because we can actually do it through remote connection, you can always get people who can be set up in their own venues, set up at home, the beers can be shipped directly to their door. It only takes us 2 days to get the beers there, so we're very, very quick and efficient at making sure that happens. And then you'll be connected to me, a live tutor who's going to walk you through the course and the content, but also get you fully interactive with the beers and discussing them not only from your point of view, but also with the rest of your class at the same time. And that's where an interactive class, where we're all in person together or online, we're all able to actually benefit the most, because it's not just you at home trying to decipher a liquid based on some information we've given you, it's you deciphering it with us. And more things become more obvious. And it's kind of like, I think for those that had done wine training before, the first time they did an SAT on beer with me, you could see that that made sense because they'd already done it. But then if you've never done an SAT, why does it make sense? It breaks it down. We're going to look at appearance first. Then we're going to look at the aromas. Then we're going to look at the palate. And then in level two, we also cover carbonation, body, finish, bitterness, and sweetness. So that breakdown really separates out how all these different characteristics play a part in the beer. And I'm going to help you understand where those flavor profiles and characteristics have come from. And that's where the trade is going to benefit the most, because you'll be able to actually have beers not only in your fridge shelves, but also being dispensed via your draft systems or on cask, that maybe you have questions about. Why does this beer have that particular aroma? Where does that aroma come from? Who can I sell this beer to? And how can I help them understand what to expect from this beer? Level 1 and level 2 cover that in very, very good detail. I would definitely say that level 1 is a great starting ground for those that are initiated into the hospitality trade, for example, have probably spent more than 6 months within the trade and need a little bit of extra help starting to understand some beer terminology and a little bit more about the ingredients. If you're probably in the trade for 2 years or more, maybe you're a supervisor, manager, looking to advance your career, you want to know about that product that is the top selling product in the UK hospitality trade. Let's not lie here. Wine is a fantastic liquid. I absolutely adore wine, but beer is the top selling product in this country. And the more you know about it, the better you are prepared to work in the industry that sells it.
Just to say that also that this is a new product by WST in terms of the course. There were beer courses being run by other providers. They're not doing it anymore. So this is the premium product, certainly in the UK, for beer and learning about beer product. There's not that many APPs. And if you want to do it, you're not, if you're in London, we are definitely people to see. But if you're not in London, you'll probably find there's, it's really hard to find someone who can run the course. Doing it online with us is a great way of getting a really good top product in terms of the presentation and enjoying it without having to travel 5 hours every day.
Well, yeah, one of our candidates on the level two we've been doing over the last 3 weeks, she mentioned the fact that she was based in the Midlands and she just didn't want to have to do an only virtual tour. She wanted something that was more interactive. She got to speak to not only a tutor and ask questions, but also interact with the rest of her class and learn from them at the same time.
And also drink the same beers as everybody.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that was the thing. I mean, the remote setup is fantastic. You've got two cameras, one facing me and the screen, one facing into the rest of your class so you can see what's going on. But then we actually send you a whole can or bottle of every single beer we're going to try. So it's kind of a win-win scenario there because the rest of the class only having maybe a third of a bottle or a half a bottle.
We'll wrap it up now. Just to say, don't forget we've got courses. We've put on them up to about the first half of the year. We've got the other half of the year. We're just holding back a little bit just because we want to check out the venues. We might move to a brewery to run some of the courses, which would be great because then you get a brewery tour as well. But not at this stage. At this stage, we're just keeping it all in Twickenham under control. But just like to say, thank you very much for the great course, Jamie.
Thank you very much, Chris, for having me.
Hopefully, the listeners have found that interesting.
That was great fun. Thank you, guys.